Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service.
The podcast exploring the minds, the motives and the money of some of the world's richest individuals.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Harriet Gilbert, host of the BBC's World Book Club. And in this bonus episode, we hear from the greatly loved and admired Irish author Edna O'Brien, who died on the 27th of July. Edna O'Brien was born in rural County Clare in 1930. Feeling suffocated by her convent education, she moved to Dublin to escape and subsequently spent much of her life in London. She published her first novel, The Country Girls, in 1960. The story of two young women friends, its groundbreaking portrayal of female sexuality scandalised Ireland. And 16 years ago, she joined us to talk about the novel with readers around the world and in the studio. Edna O'Brien, welcome to the World Book Club.
Thank you. I'm delighted.
It's getting on for half a century now since you wrote The Country Girls. Do you feel somewhat detached and remote from it?
Well, not really, because whatever you write, whether it's 10 minutes ago or 48 years ago, is sort of in your consciousness. And also, those two girls were my start off in life as a writer. I'd always wanted to write, and apparently I was once in a bookshop in Galway when I was still a pharmacy student, and they had photographs of writers along the wall, Samuel Beckett, Sean O'Casey, and I said, I'll be there one day. Well, I don't remember saying it, but they tell me I did. I don't feel it distant because Ireland, although the characters Kate and Baba are the pulse of the novel, the character is also the country, Ireland, and that landscape, which has been sometimes troubling for me, but is also a very, very deep inspiration.
Well, Edna O'Brien is now a superstar of Irish literature. She's written not only 20 novels, including most recently The Light of Evening, but also short stories, screenplays, plays, and a biography of James Joyce. In the process, she's accumulated a shelf full of prizes. But the novel that began it all was The Country Girls. Set in 1950s Ireland, it's narrated by Kathleen Brady, who at the start is a somewhat anxious 14-year-old. Her father tends to disappear for days, spend more money than he owns on drink, then come home maudlin and violent. It's no wonder that the family farm is only just holding together. And when Kathleen's mother dies, the young girl's life falls completely apart. As she says, it was the last day of childhood. Kathleen's taken in by the family of her boisterous, bullying friend Baba. And eventually the two children are sent to a convent boarding school, a place for pleasure-loving Baba especially of unmitigated ghastliness. So much so that she contrives to get not only herself but Kathleen expelled. And in the final section of the novel, we follow them to the capital, to Dublin, where now 18, they throw themselves into cigarettes, booze and older men, including, for Kathleen, a half-chaste affair with a married man called Mr. Gentleman, a neighbour from back home. But, Edna O'Brien, I wonder if you'd start by reading from a slightly earlier part of the novel. And this is Kathleen confronted by her first night in the Roman Catholic convent boarding school.
I remember it. I got in between the icy sheets and ate a piece of seed cake. The whole dormitory was crying. You could hear the sobbing and choking under the covers, smothered crying. The head of my bed backed onto the head of another girl's bed, and in the dark a hand came through the rungs and put a bun on my pillow. It was an iced bun, and there was something on top of the icing, possibly a cherry. I gave her a piece of cake, and then we shook hands. I wondered what she looked like, as I hadn't noticed her when the lights were on. She was a nice girl, whoever she was, and the bun was nice too. Two or three beds away, I heard some girl munch an apple under the covers. Everyone seemed to be eating and crying for their mothers. My bed faced a window, and I could see a sprinkling of stars in one small corner of the sky. It was nice to lie there, watching the stars, waiting for them to fade or go out, or to flare up into a brilliant firework, waiting for something to happen in that deathly, unhappy silence.
Edna O'Brien, thank you very much for that. And now a question about the Country Girls from the BBC World Book Club audience.
I'm Ross Settles, a school teacher from East Sussex. What were your aims in writing The Country Girls?
Oh, it's a very grand question, and my aims are much less grand. I'll tell you exactly. I always, as I mentioned a moment ago, wanted to write, but I was very unschooled and was writing foolish sentences, to tell you the truth. I read manuscripts, for which I got paid a guinea, which was a big hunk of money to me.
£1, 1 shilling can't remember.
And the editor, the chairman of that house, his name was Ian Hamilton, he's now dead, he asked me to write a book because he thought I had some gifts. Coincided with my coming to England. I was married, I had two small children, and I was earning a guinea a week, yes? So he gave me 50 quid, pounds, not guineas, to write this book. I spent it immediately on things for my children, and to please the man I was married to, I bought a sewing machine, which I have never used and never intend to. But deep down, of course, was the longing to write. So my aim, as far as I could consciously tell it to you, was to relive and, if possibly, in some form, transmute the experiences of my life up to then. I was 23 or something. To transmute them into something richer and better and funnier, of course, than life. And I think T.S. Eliot put it one time, he said, humankind cannot bear too much reality. And then the last thing I think I could say was, I wrote it in my children's bedroom after they went to school in the morning. It took me 3 weeks. They take 4 years now. And I was weeping. Even though the book, I think it's slightly funny, I hope it is, certainly funnier than ones I've recently written, I was weeping for a land that I had left and gladly left and did not wish to go back to, and to find language, to find each word has to do justice to its existence there. So there were a good lot of aims, and I had spent the £50.
Another question for Edna O'Brien.
Hello, my name is Catherine Chasey from Camden Libraries. Following on from that question, I was just wondering how much of the character of Kathleen was autobiographical, and, as you suggested from when you started to read your first extract, perhaps also the life at the convent.
Well, it certainly is pretty autobiographical. I'd be a liar if I said it wasn't. However, in my own defence, I'd like to think that Baba's a bit of my character as well. Kathleen and obedience and temperance and purity and just, I don't know, all the other words, you know them yourself, were my overt self, and this rebellious creature was my hidden self. As regards the convent locale, a writer needs locale. I often get very envious. I open books and, you know, they give you the blurb about the photograph of the writer, always handsome, male or female. And then, particularly with American novels, you get that this person was a lorry driver, a crane driver, worked in a restaurant, had six other... And I think, God, I only went to a convent and worked in a chemist shop. But at least I put them to some use. You cannot write a book unless you know everything, the carpet, this table, the leg of the table, those chairs. You have to have the reality in order to soar.
Certainly. I mean, the extract you just read, it was as if you really had lain in that bed and been that little girl who was looking out of the window.
Well, looking out and looking in. Harriet said to me earlier, which of course came as a slight surprise to me, she said, I didn't realise they had all that food in the convent.
But they didn't at my school.
No, but the thing is, it was their first night. And when you come from home, you're given a bit of cake or an apple or a bun. But the place is always essential. And there's a few other essentials that one has to search for.
Edna O'Brien, this next question for you comes from Ekaterinburg in Russia. It's from Lina Chikalova, and she has emailed this. Dear Edna O'Brien, what did you feel when your book was banned in Ireland? Did you feel that you'd underestimated how strongly people would react to it?
I did underestimate. She's absolutely right there. Mind you, I wasn't in Russia and sent to a gulag, I'd like to mention in parentheses. I'll tell you what happened when it was banned. I was more concerned by the anger and wrath of my mother and people at home in the house than this general being banned by the censor board. The censor board were four opaque men in a room in Dublin. By opaque, I mean no one knew who they were. They were nameless and faceless in their suits. And to ban a book in those days in Ireland, it's laughable, really. When you think of hedonist Ireland now, you or I or anyone here could send in three offending lines, not the book, you didn't even have to buy the book, send in three offending lines on page 94, and the book got banned. It was quick, it was clockwork. But however, it was hurtful. My mother was appalled. She was appalled that I had written the book, and then this mantle of shame. So to answer our friend in Russia, I was taken aback. I was a bit shook up. I suppose I was also very angry. Because to write a book, you have to put heart, soul, mind, and every other area of your being into it. And to get castigated for a crime you have not committed is not fair. But as I said, I was not in Russia and not in a gulag. But it didn't stop me commencing my next book.
Well, the next question for you, Edna O'Brien, comes from a fellow novelist, a fellow Irish woman novelist. She couldn't be here today, but she's the winner of the 2007 Man Booker Prize for Fiction, Anne Enright, and we're going to hear her now.
Hello, Edna. This is Anne Enright here. I'm delighted to have this opportunity now to ask you a question. I've been a great fan ever since I read this book, in fact, as a girl myself. You know, people think this book is soaked in Catholicism, but I actually think that a big counter impulse is the urge to dress. And there's fantastic clothing in it, and there's fantastic clothing in all your work, and there's fantastic underwear. Did you deliberately set this female flowering of this wonderful showing off that dressing entails against a repressive Catholic tradition.
And congratulations on winning. Was her question, did I doll them up?
She was saying that a lot of people think the novel is about Catholicism, but she thinks that actually it's about clothing, that it's about, she said it's full of fantastic clothing and underwear. Was this a sort of counter force to religion and repression?
No, I don't think so. I think that is actually making it maybe perhaps too important. It is a book about Catholicism and repression. I think every young girl dreams of clothes and a nice slip. There were slips in those days, and they were wonderful colours, like pale blue and turquoise. I saw them in shop windows, I might add. I didn't own one. So our question is fine, but it's only this, you know, fraction of what their real reason, Baba and Kate. Certainly they wanted clothes, but what they wanted above all else was freedom.
Well, we have a question now that was rung into the BBC World Book Club from Guam in the Western Pacific. It's from Helen Thompson.
Hello, Edna. This is Helen Thompson. I am an Associate Professor of Women and Gender Studies at the University of Guam in the Western Pacific. My specialty is Irish women writers, and I am currently completing a book of literary criticism about your work. I'm delighted to have the chance to ask you about The Country Girls, which I consider to be a very important novel. I wanted to ask you about your influences when you were writing The Country Girls. Did you read any women writers? And did you have any exposure to the women's movement? Thank you.
My first influence of book was reading this little extract, a short book T.S. Eliot did on James Joyce. Now, Helen has asked me what women writers I read at that time. And like every young aspiring woman, I had read and devoured and reread the Brontes. I'd read Jane Austen, but she didn't, you know, she's saner than the Brontes. I admire her utterly, and in fact, increasingly. But the Brontes were of the women, and I'm trying to think. Well, I can't think of any other of that at this moment, because you see, in my convent there was no literature, only prayer books. And then when I worked in Dublin in the shop, there was no cash money to buy books. I saw the James Joyce book in a stall out of doors in Bachelor's Walk in Dublin. I could have stolen it, actually. The man didn't mind. I mean, no one else was going to buy it. And I bought it for sixpence. So my reading was limited, but my intensity was vast.
Another question now from the World Book Club audience.
Hello, Edna. My name is Naraini. I'm a Malaysian living in London. My question is, whatever happened to Mr. Gentleman? Did you marry him?
Did I marry him? No, no.
Kathleen certainly doesn't.
Well, now, in my life, was there a Mr. Gentleman? There was certainly an element of a Mr. Gentleman. But no, I never married him. See, you write better about the people, really, that you don't marry. No, I shouldn't say that. That's half true. Mr. Gentleman was a figure romanticised by me, because if Mrs. Gentleman had written about it, it would be a very different story. So there was an element of Mr. Gentleman whom I then took into my little daft brain and recreated. But as with for every novelist, there are many people in Dublin who would tell you, if you happen to visit there, that they know exactly who Mr. Gentleman was, except they're not right.
Well, let's return Kathleen and Baba centre stage. It'd be nice to have a very short reading now from the book of The Country Girls, where the two girls are finally, for the first time in their life, they're on a train to Dublin and they're unaccompanied.
Christ's sake, where's there a smoking carriage? Baba asked. Her father had put us on the train, but we didn't let on that we each had a packet of cigarettes in our handbags. We'll look for one, I said. And we went down the corridor, giggling and giving strangers the so-what look. I suppose it was then we began that phase of our lives as the giddy country girls brazening the big city. People looked at us, and then looked away again as though they had just discovered that we were naked or something. But we didn't care. We were young and, we thought, pretty.
Thank you. And there's a question from the back of the audience here at Bush House.
Hello. My name's Juno Cheetle. I'm from Sherkin Island in West Cork in Ireland. I just wanted to know, I thought that some of the tenderest moments in the book were between the mother and Kate, and the fact that the mother was lost quite soon into the novel. Did that have any bearing on her needing to fall into love with Mr. Gentleman, in that by losing a love, she needed another love in her life?
Very much so. Absolutely. And I think all loss, which everybody in this room has experienced to greater and lesser degree, is terrible. But it is also in us as humans is this quality or secret zone in which with our loss we either consciously or unconsciously want it replaced. It's not as obvious as that we'd go out that night and find another person. And certainly Kate's love of Mr. Gentleman, in many ways, why they thought the book was a smear on Irish womanhood, you could be guessing till the cows come home. Her love of Mr. Gentleman is very idealized. And although she, kisses him once or is kissed by him, it is not unlike, although he's a man, her mother was a woman, it has some replication to the love she had for her mother in its intensity, and it being, it's also the first. The mother love is the first love, and I think it's true for many people, not just me, and is ongoing. And the first man or other love object, if it be a woman, that we fall in love with, is, in a way, all the others have a tracing of that as time goes on.
Thank you. Another question for Edna O'Brien.
Hello, I'm Jenny Winters. I'm Irish, but I teach literature to teenage girls here in London. And I'm currently, they have an option where they choose a novel, a 20th century novel, and I'm trying to encourage them to read The Country Girls. What would you say to a teenage girl in London now to encourage them to read it?
Oh, God. Oh, this is not going to be easy. I think you'd have to chain them. But to entice somebody or a class of people to read is a very, very hard thing, because many people, they don't want to read. Reading is a very, very serious and thrilling discipline. And Sartre said once, to read a book is to write it. It isn't quite. James Joyce would not have wished that his brother had written his book. He wrote it. But it's what Sartre meant, that, if you read this book, whatever book it be, you'll feel differently. It will do something to you. I remember when I was writing the play of Virginia Woolf, and I naturally, her diaries and her letters, which are works of genius, I was rereading them. And poor Virginia, her mind was uncontainable, as you know. And in one of her letters, she says, "I will go home." And she was in Lewis in the cottage in Sussex. "I will go home and sit by the fire and fill my mind with the Elizabethans." And it's true. When I read a scene of Othello, just one scene, because it's so great that I can't read the whole play at once, I am definitely altered. My consciousness is altered. My appetite for life, my sense of the marvel. So you could tell her all that, but you won't listen.
Well, we have a question now that was rung into the BBC World Book Club by Lisa Giraud-Taylor in France. Yes. And here she is asking it.
Hello, Mrs. O'Brien. My name is Lisa Giraud-Taylor. I live in Marseille in Provence. And I've been reading your books in French and love them. I read in an interview you gave to the French daily newspaper Libération back in June 2001, you said, "Les gens heureux n'écrivent pas," which means happy people don't write. I think you might be right about this, but I would love to hear what do you exactly mean by that. Nevertheless, you make people happy while reading your words, so I thank you.
You were quoted in the French newspaper Libération as saying at one time, happy people don't write.
Oh, absolutely, that's true. Oh, I stand by that. I misheard it. I thought she said, ugly people don't write. So I was getting all defensive. I think what I meant and what I could, for a second, clarify is the need to write, the time of writing, and the total exclusion of all else, husband, wife, child, world, everything else required to write, is not the occupation of a normal, happy, sane person. It's not. Who would spend 2 weeks trying to describe what this room... Well, actually, this room is a very bad example. But to
because no one would want to describe it.
To describe a scene as Proust does. I mean, Proust was mad to take all those pages to get from there to there. So I think a happy person is happier than I certainly would accord myself as being. I still wouldn't change my job if I could, although I sometimes wish it. What is required is a sensitiveness. I don't want to sound, you know, too grand about this. Everything goes in. The good things go in, and the little cruelties go in, and the awful things. And in order for those to go in, you have to be completely naked. Naked, naked. And that doesn't lead to a happy or a carefree. It couldn't. I wouldn't like to leave this evening by saying I am direly unhappy, but happiness isn't the very top of my list. Never will be.
Well, that is all the questions we've got time for. For now, though, from me, Harriet Gilbert, and my producer, Oliver Jones, thank you to all you members of the BBC World Book Club, whether listening at home or here at Bush House. And thanks especially to this month's guest, Edna O'Brien. Thank you for listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. That edition of World Book Club was with the acclaimed Irish author Edna O'Brien, who died last month. To hear more episodes featuring such internationally celebrated writers as Isabel Allende, Günter Grass, Percival Everett or Kiran Desai, search World Book Club wherever you found this podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.